As Chief Justice Gilbertson is participating by telephone, he has designated the Honorable Stephen L. Zinter as presiding justice in the courtroom.
And the second case today is the matter of Michael Ortner, Mr. Robert Freeburg for the board, and Mr. Gene LeBrun for Mr. Ortner. I believe it's customary, Mr. Freeburg, you go first.
May it please the court, counsel, Mr. Ortner. The disciplinary board considered this matter at its January meeting. As is evident from the record before this court, there's been no dispute about the events that occurred. The basic problem that brought this matter to the board's attention came to the board from the opinion that was issued by this court earlier in the Reeser matter. The board thereupon initiated its own investigation, conducted its hearing, and then filed with this court its findings, conclusions, and recommendation. The recommendation of the board, of course, is that Mr. Ortner be publicly censured. Given that there's no particular dispute about the underlying facts in this matter, nor is there any dispute really with the findings and conclusions and recommendation. As I understand Mr. Ortner's response, he has accepted and agreed to the findings and recommendations made by the board. So I thought perhaps the best thing for me to do would be to try to mention to you what the board looked at as it came to its recommendation in this matter. Probably the two things that were most significant, at least as the board has related to me, as they sometimes do when they know I'm coming here to represent their views, is that they view this as not an effort on Mr. Ortner's part to cover up a misdeed on his own part. For example,
are they bound by Judge Delaney's decision and this court's decision in Reeser? Are they attempting to retry that?
They are not. They are not attempting to retry that, Chief Justice Gilbertson. But the board looked at this in the sense that as they compared this, for example, to the Arndt matter that was recently before the board, or the Wilka matter that was recently before the board, both of which have been before this court, that in each of those instances, the board saw that as the lawyer's effort to cover up his own misdeed. In this case, the purpose of what Mr. Ortner did in the view of the board, at least some of the board members, was that this was no personal benefit to himself, that this was a benefit to someone whom he represented, that he wasn't trying to cover up something that he had done. And they took the view that once this came to his attention, the affidavit that he filed, which as I understand it was probably in the second stage of these subsequent proceedings in the Reeser case, was straightforward and candid with respect to what he had done.
Well, the Wilka and the Eicher case of the attorney received no personal benefit either from the attempt to mislead the court. And would you agree with that?
Well, I think the board, I would agree that he got no personal benefit. But I think in Wilka particularly, the board took the view that because of the persistent nature of the misrepresentation, that Wilka was really seeking to cover his own tail as well. I think that's how at least that's how some of the board members expressed it to me, Your Honor.
Thank you.
The second consideration is, of course, is genuine remorse for what happened. Although I wasn't present at the hearing, as you know from the record, in the findings and in my own conversation with at least some of the board members, there's no doubt that Mr. Ortner is genuinely remorseful, regrets what he did, and as he said, sleepless nights on account of what happened here. Finally, I think the board took into consideration its most important responsibility in all of these matters is the protection of the public. I think that is the first and foremost responsibility of this court, certainly. I think the board takes that as their first and foremost responsibility as well. And under those circumstances, the board felt that Mr. Ortner was not going to be a threat to the public, that he has had a good reputation, has served well in the past, and that there was no concern that letting him continue to practice would be a threat to the good of the public who are served by him.
Counsel, protection of the public goes beyond Mr. Ortner. It goes to every member of the state bar. Would a public censure for these admitted facts send a strong enough message to the other members of the bar that it would hopefully persuade them not to engage in this type of conduct in the future?
I think that was the board's attitude, certainly, Your Honor. I think the most responsible lawyers certainly look at a public censure as a pretty severe sanction. It doesn't take them out of the practice, but it's next to it. And I do think that was a thoughtful and considered position that the board took. With that, I have nothing further, I think, to present on behalf of the board. If there are questions, of course, I'd be pleased to try to answer them for you.
I just have one clarification. The first point you made where the board felt there was a distinguishing factor between covering up your own misdeeds and as has happened in some of the other cases. And what happened here, you know, in a way it seems to me that it's worse to, as an officer of a court, to deceive the court than it is to try to cover up to a board or somebody else something you may have done wrong. Can you give any further clarification on what you meant by that?
Well, and I've thought about that too, Justice Center, and I think it's a fine line. It may be one of those things that's somewhat in the eye of the beholder, to tell you the truth. But I do believe that I'm familiar with, I think the Chief mentioned Eicher. I'm familiar with that case, of course. I'm familiar with the Wilka case and with the Arndt case. In each of those instances, I think the board saw that the lawyer's conduct at the outset was, or that at least brought them to the board's attention, was aimed at really the lawyer's own motivation, the lawyer's own position with respect to what was going on. And the board saw that what Mr. Ortner had done, recognizing this happened a long time before it ever came to light, frankly, was really aimed only to try to get this divorce done in a way in which it appeared both people were agreeing to get it done, and so that it didn't really serve him at all to have these people do this. He knew them, he knew what was going on. I think that the board saw a difference in at least the quality of what Mr. Ortner did as opposed to the quality of the acts in Eicher, in Wilka, and certainly in Arndt. I think there the board frankly felt that a misrepresentation like that to the board, knowing that the board was, you know, in a way your first agent in this whole process of lawyer discipline, was really going to be a misrepresentation to you if the board hadn't discovered that.
You're not suggesting it's worse to misrepresent to the board than to the court, are you?
Not at all. But I think, I know it's the board's position that the canon, that's a 3.3, do I want to say, about candor to the tribunal includes the disciplinary board.
Okay.
I know that's their position.
Okay, but you're not prioritizing one over the other. Misrepresentation is a misrepresentation, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. LeBron.
May it please the court, Mr. Freeburg. First of all, on behalf of Mr. Orkin and myself, we want to thank Mr. Freeburg, Tom Barnett, and the members of the board, as well as this court, for the time and effort that we know goes into assuring the members of the bar, the people of South Dakota, that the legal profession is held to the high position it should be and to which the people deserve. So we do appreciate the time and effort that the board and Mr. Freeburg have given to this matter. Now, this court is well aware of what instigated this particular matter. It was, of course, the decision by this court in the Reese versus Twist case. The board held a hearing in January and made its findings of fact, conclusions of law, recommendations, and filed its formal accusations with this court. Now, I realize there are a couple of you that were not a member of the panel on the Reese case, although I think you're probably familiar with the case. Let me just quickly outline. Mike Orton has been practicing law in Hot Springs since 1979, and in 1999 he took the representation of David Reeser in a divorce matter. It was probably a typical no contest divorce. It provided for child custody, child support issues, property division, but it was a typical what I would call a default divorce. Mrs. Reeser, although waived her right to have an attorney, Mike was aware that her mother and her stepfather were both lawyers, so he assumed that she was probably consulting them for legal advice. Now, we don't know if that's the case, but he knew that there were lawyers in her family. The parties had agreed between the two of them that on the issues of custody, property division, and child support, and had told Mike, as the attorney for the husband, that they had agreed that the non-custodial parent would not pay child support payments to the one who had the custody of the children, Mr. Reeser for, well, I believe, 10 months, and Mrs. Reeser for the 2 months. So Mike prepared the stipulation to present to Judge Kern along those lines. When he gave it to Judge Kern, he advised her there was something unusual about this particular stipulation for this divorce, and that was that there was no provision for child support. He told her that, as Judge Kern, of course, as you all are well aware, refused to grant the divorce based upon that type of stipulation. So Mike went back and told his client, David Reeser, that Judge Kern would not grant the divorce based upon that type of stipulation, that there has to be some child support provision. So David Reeser went back to talk to his wife and told her that. And they insisted, and they came back, or that David Reeser came back to Mike and said, well, that's fine, but we really don't want to provide for child support. And Mike said, well, you can tear up the checks if you want. And they said, and he said, no, Mrs. Reeser wants something in writing. So Mike did that. He prepared that private agreement, which provided an effect that the non-custodial parent would not have to pay child support to the one that did have the custody. He then also prepared a stipulation which provided for a $250 per month child support from the non-custodial parent to the other. Took that back to Judge Kern. Judge Kern looked at it and granted the divorce based upon that. Now, Mike will tell you that he told the Reesers, David, that although this may be enforceable between the two of you, it's not going to be binding in any court should it ever come to that. So they were well aware of that. Well, as you know, 3 years later, on post-divorce proceedings, this matter came up. Mike was not involved in that litigation. Both parties are different lawyers. But in the course of matters, the fact that there was the side agreement did come forward. Interesting enough, that in none of those cases, the post-divorce proceedings, did anybody ask Mike for that agreement? In fact, I don't know. I would assume that that agreement was probably not before this court when you decided the Reeser versus Twist case, although there may have been a copy. I just don't know that. In any event, as you well aware, after your decision was made, the Bar Disciplinary Board chose to conduct an investigation and sent Mike the letter. Now, all of these facts are set forth in detail in the board's findings on that they made on February 15th of 2002. Mike Ortner fully admits and agrees to those findings, every one of them. He fully concurs with the board's recommendations and with the board's conclusions of law. And of course, he has no dispute or no quarrel with what the board has recommended in terms of a sanction. And I think what I'd like to do is to read the court the first thing that Michael Ortner told the board at that January 7th hearing. He said, first of all, I'd like to apologize to my fellow members of the board of the bar. There's no excuse for what I did. He concluded his remarks before the board by again testifying, what I did, there's no excuse for it. I was not upfront with Judge Curran. There is no excuse for it. I'm sorry. Now, that's been Mike's firm and sincere position and attitude since he first contacted me shortly after he received the notice from the board. I don't think anything expresses Mike's deep feeling of remorse, apology, and regret more than his letter to Judge Curran of October 19th of 2004, which was in the record as Exhibit 7. In that letter, Mike stated, I cannot adequately express how deeply I apologize to you for the way I mishandled the visa divorce 5.5 years ago. My heart and emotions totally got in the way of my brain and legal training. He fully recognized his mistake, as he concluded in his letter to Judge Curran, what I did in this case clearly violates the rules of professional responsibility. I am ready to accept whatever action is recommended by the disciplinary board. As Mr. Freeberg has pointed out, Mike fully cooperated with the board. He went down to the hearing, he brought his file, he answered their questions, he presented that private contractual agreement. And as I stated, he has no quarrel with their findings, with their conclusions, their recommendations. Now the board concluded that, and I quote here, the board said, while Ortner violated rules 3.3 and 8.4 of the rules of professional conduct, no public interest or professional purpose would be served by suspending Ortner's privilege to practice law. As I stated, Mike had no quarrel with that finding a recommendation of the board. Now, I'm fully aware that this court is not bound by the recommendation of the disciplinary board. However, I think the court, I can call the court's attention perhaps, some of the cases which I know the board looked at and which I've looked at where similar matters have been before this court. There have been matters before this court on lawyers who have been dishonest with the trial court, not fully disclosed matters to the trial court. And I'd like to call the attention of the court to especially four, I guess, particular cases. One is the matter in the discipline of Wrench, 1983 case. In that case, Mr. Wrench misrepresented to the judge the status of a fee agreement that he had with an indigent defendant in a criminal prosecution. He had intentionally deceived the court about receiving some property as a fee, which conduct was prejudicial to the administration of justice. This court agreed with the recommendation of the board and imposed the sanction of a public censure. In the 1992 case of the matter of the discipline of Schmidt, this court agreed also with the recommendation of the board and issued a public censure. In that case, the attorney Schmidt filed a motion to have his brother admitted broad beaching before this court and did not disclose the fact that his brother had in fact had some disciplinary matters in his home state of Minnesota. Again, that was a misrepresentation of the court. It was a false statement, and the court agreed that a public censure was the proper discipline. Another matter, I guess what I would call the Bob Mines number one matter, the 1994 matter, this court again agreed with the disciplinary board and recommended public censure. In that case, Mr. Mines had advised the court that he had filed an action in federal court in an effort to get a state court case dismissed. In fact, he had not yet filed his action in federal court, and he knew that. Again, it was a misrepresentation to the trial court, and the court so found, but again, public censure was the discipline that was imposed. And finally, this court has just mentioned to Mr. Freeberg, the Welker case, of course, in that case, in the 2001 case, there was a misrepresentation about some drug testing. It was clearly a fraud, misrepresentation to the court. He was charged with the same rules of discipline, of the violation of professional rules as here, the 3.3 and the 8.4. And again, the board recommended public censure, and that's what this court imposed on the attorney. We submit that such a sanction would clearly fulfill the purpose of disciplinary proceedings that have been enunciated by this court, and that is not to punish the lawyer, but to protect the public from further wrongdoing by the lawyer who is entrusted with the duties and responsibilities that belong to the members of our legal profession.
Mr. LeBrun, now, you just listed Rent, Schmidt, Mines, Wilka. I think to that we can add Eicher and Voorhees. That's a lot of cases involving, in my opinion, misrepresentations to the court. Is the sanction of public censure, given this long list of cases where we're repeatedly seeing the same offense, is the sanction of censure strong enough to send a message to the rest of the bar that this is not going to be tolerated?
Well, I agree it shouldn't be tolerated, Chief Justice. I think it is, and I'd say in this case, in addition to the public censure, if that's what this court decides, I think the language that Justice Zinter put in the Reeser versus Twist case sent a message to the bar. I know in our office, we have a Monday morning meeting where we discuss recent decisions from this court, and that decision warranted a lengthy discussion about the message that was sent in it. And I suspect that happened throughout the bar in South Dakota. So I think in addition to whatever censure imposed upon Mr. Ortner, the decision that this court's already handed down has sent a strong message to the bar. And I think, you know, if you look at Judge Kern's letter that was submitted to the board, Exhibit 7, she talks about what happens frequently in divorce cases. And I know I've talked to Judge Fuller, who also wrote a letter. I know Judge Delaney feels this way, that particularly in domestic relations cases, the lawyers may not be as strong. I'll rephrase that. Perhaps they're too much of an advocate for their clients and don't question what their client tells them. They want to get those divorces final, especially in a non-contested divorce. I'm advised by some of these trial courts that this goes on more than should go on. In fact, as Judge Kern points out, a party on a divorce case may not be real accurate with the lawyer about what the assets are in the marriage. May not be real honest about plans to remarry, things like that.
Well, the client, but what about the lawyers?
I think Judge Kern sets it forth in her letter, and I know Judge Delaney has said it, that the lawyers don't always question their clients enough. Is that really the fact? I don't think.
But isn't the issue here, is it? I mean, here.
No, not in this case.
I mean, what may happen in other cases may be interesting, but that is not the set of facts that are before us in order, correct?
I completely agree with you, Judge Miller. The only reason I was bringing that up is the chief asked me, is this a strong enough message?
I see, okay.
And I think what I'm hearing the trial court judges say is that they think all lawyers who involve, especially in domestic relations cases, probably should take a stronger look at how they garner information from their own clients.
Okay, thank you.
But to answer your question, Chief, I really think that between a public censure in this case and the already issued a decision in the Reeser versus Twist case, I think the bar has gotten a strong message. I really do.
What our most recent case that hasn't been discussed in your presentation is, of course, the Arndt case.
I'm sorry?
The Arndt case. That's the one that hasn't been discussed. I think that's probably our last case or one of our last cases. That was 120-day, if I recall, suspension. How would you distinguish that case?
Judge, I know I've read that case, and I'm honest with you, I'm trying to remember the facts.
That was submission of a letter that had been falsified to the disciplinary board.
I would distinguish it by this word you used. It was falsified. What Mike Ortner did was not to falsify anything. He just did fail to disclose to the court that the parties had this side agreement.
But he knew.
I don't believe there's a falsification there.
But he knew how important this was to Judge Kern because, as you indicated in your opening presentation, he went out of his way to tell her up front the first time that this was not in there. So he obviously knew how important this was to Judge Kern.
So that's very correct, and I would agree with you completely, Justice. I think. And he told his clients, you know, hey, you can guys enter into this agreement and I'll draft it for you. And it may be enforced between the two of you. He didn't say it would be, it may be. But he told them, hey, this is not going to be binding on a court. And his first advice is, look, we can put it in there. If you don't want a faster check, you can tear it up. But apparently Mrs. Risa wanted something in writing. So he made a mistake. He did what his clients asked him. But I don't think it would be, I don't think it rises to the level of a falsification. It's a failure to disclose to the trial court. And for that, he's very sorry, of course.
I just have a question. So it was his client's idea to draft this secret agreement?
My understanding, and Michael will address the court, is that when he told his client, the husband, David, that the judge would not grant the divorce on no support, the client went back and talked to his wife and came back and said, hey, she wants something in writing. That's my understanding of it anyway. I'd like to ask the court if they allow Mike, you'd like to address the court briefly and answer any questions you have, unless you got further questions of me.
That would be appropriate. Thank you.
Thank you.
Honorable members of the court, Freeburg, Mr. LeBron. I stand before you today, again, to express my deepest apologies for what I did. About a little over 6 years ago, most deeply I have apologized and expressed my regrets to Judge Kern. She's always treated me more than fairly. She's a tremendous judge. She knows what she's doing. I regret so much what I did in that matter. My convoluted thinking, whatever, when I drafted that agreement at my client's insistence, at his wife's insistence, the strange thinking going on in my head was that I drafted it, it says, not that you won't pay support, it says, I, plaintiff, will not seek to enforce this support order against the wife in those 10 months that he would have custody, and vice versa, she would not seek to enforce the support order in the 2 months that she would have custody in the summer. And that, again, you know, that was my thinking then. It was not honest with the court.
That's Mr. Ortner, at the time you drafted that agreement, in your own mind, did you feel what you were doing was improper?
In my mind, I basically was blocking the fact that it was misrepresenting to the court. I had known Mr. Reeser for probably 20 years. I'd been going to brandings with him and his father for about 20 years. There was strong personal feelings there, trying to help out David, and I forgot my duty to the court. I have no excuse for it, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Since that time, and I guess even, you know, since the hearing in January, Judge Delaney has called me into his court, has spoken to me about this. Frankly, back at the time when this was before Judge Delaney, he called me in before him and probably took off about half of my left cheek at that time, and very appropriately so. He's been very supportive of me in this matter, certainly not condoning what I did.
Mr. Ortner, if you knew it was wrong from the outset, and then you knew about the litigation in Reeser and the, in fact, you submitted an affidavit, and I see from the letter that you wrote to Judge Kern, you indicate that you haven't slept since.
Well, I've slept, very... but I sleep fitfully.
I understand, but why didn't you self-report this? When you first realized the gravity of what had occurred here?
I didn't really think of that. The first thing I had was, I guess, when Greg Barnier contacted me. And I think, like, when the case was going on with Judge Trimble, nothing, that was never mentioned in any way. I never even thought of it. I was not contacted by any attorneys, any clients. No one has ever asked to see, in my file, I still have all of their, the handwritten property settlement that they had signed, the handwritten agreements on child custody, the handwritten agreements that they both signed about the no support. There were allegations that there were assets that were hidden or something like that. There were no assets, that they had about $80,000 of debts that his father agreed to pay off. It's my understanding that he had something like a 1% interest in the farm corporation. I did not know that. I was not told that at that time. Father later, who at that time I was not on the county commissioner, and this was those years ago, about 5 years ago, I went on the county commission, and 2 years later, his father is now on the county commission, also with me out there. Father had mentioned to me that this 1% interest, father had to go out and borrow money to pay off the marital indebtedness, but that he had taken back that 1% interest in the ranch for paying off all the marital debt, most of which, my understanding was, most of which was incurred by the husband.
Your time has about expired. Unless there's other questions from members of the court, I'd ask you to maybe...
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Your time has expired, but I'd like you to conclude with some remarks if you'd like to, unless someone else on the court has questions. If not, then would you like to make a concluding remark?
I think in conclusion, Your Honors, I'm here to accept whatever you decide is appropriate. I couldn't be more sorry over what happened. I can assure you that it was an aberration in my practice of law. Practiced for about 26 and a half years now. I've been doing public service for about 40 years in this state, and I am just most sincerely sorry, and I apologize. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Freeberg?
I don't think there's anything more I could add, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay, we'll be in recess until 11 o'clock.